Welcome to the documentary from the BBC World Service, where we report the world, however difficult the issue, however hard to reach. Podcasts from the BBC World Service are supported by advertising.
Did you know that it's 50 years this week since Richard Nixon became the first US president in history to resign from office? To mark this monumental moment, Witness History brings you five programmes about influential events in US presidential history. And with all the amazing twists and turns in the current race for the White House, what a time to bring you them. You'll hear about the closest US election in history and from the man who was in the Situation Room during the raid on Osama bin Laden. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
Hello, this is the documentary from the BBC World Service. I'm Caroline Steele, and welcome to this bonus episode of The Engineers Intelligent Machines. This year, we went to the Science Specialist University, Imperial College London, to focus on the technical revolution defining our era, artificial intelligence. To help me, I was joined by a panel of three world leaders in the field and a large, enthusiastic audience in Imperial's Great Hall.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Intelligent machines are remaking our world. The speed of their improvement is accelerating fast, and every day there are more things that they can do better than us. Already a computer can defeat the world's greatest player at our most complex strategy game. The first movie, written entirely by AI, has just been released, and AI may have discovered our first antibiotic in three decades. Together with our partners, Royal Commission 1851, we've brought together three engineers at the cutting edge of this field to discuss their work and what it means for us humans. Paolo Pirjonian is Armenian, but he was born in Iran and started his career working on Mars rovers for NASA. He's now founder and CEO of Embodied, which is a company that builds emotionally intelligent robots to help with child development. David Silver is from the UK, where he's principal research scientist at the AI research lab Google DeepMind. He led the team that used AI to defeat the world's best player at the complicated strategy game Go. And he's working on artificial general intelligence, which is a type of AI capable of a broad range of thinking tasks, much like us humans. Regina Barzilai is Israeli-American and a distinguished professor for AI and health at MIT in the US. She created a major breakthrough in detecting early-stage breast cancer and also led the team that used AI to discover what is hoped to be a brand new antibiotic. So please do join me in welcoming them all. Regina, let's start with you. So what is it that made you shift your work to oncology? Sadly, you were in the perfect position to do that, weren't you?
Yeah, so actually I started my work at MIT in 2003 as a faculty, and I was working on natural language processing and AI. And in 2014, I was diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was treated in one of the best hospitals in the United States, Massachusetts General Hospital. And what I discovered going through the treatment, that there was really no AI or not even basic information technology as part of the treatment, neither the diagnostics, nor the treatment, nor the post-treatment. And, you know, after I was treated, and I'm really grateful for my doctors who treated me, I just was totally confused as to what I want to do, because it was the first time I realized that, you know, my life is finite. And I've seen a lot of very sick people there surrounding me. And I was thinking, what can I do? And MGH, this hospital, and MIT are just one subway stop away. They're separated by a bridge. I'm thinking, how come we have all this great technology at MIT, but none of it is actually coming to the hospitals and helping patients? So after I finished my treatment, I still didn't have my hair. I started kind of going from doctor to doctor, asking them, you know, how I can bring AI. I will do it for free. I'm a professor. So there were not many takers, but eventually it was a doctor called Connie Lehmann who had the idea that we can apply AI to do early detection of cancer. Right now, many of you who are thinking about AI in radiology are thinking about detecting. The doctors are doing a reasonably good job in detecting what you have now, but the question is, can you predict what's going to come in the next few years? And that's how I started my career in applying and building machine learning models for oncology.
Thank you, Regina. Paolo, your early life was spent in Iran and then as a refugee in Denmark. And I hear your introduction to computing came from a decision made by the Spanish government. Could you explain what happened there?
Yes, what a serendipity. As typical immigrant family, I was bound to become a doctor. until the moment this summer, I was in high school, I had saved up a little bit of money, bought a ticket to go to Spain for a week. A couple of days before the flight, the Spanish government changed the law, which required me to have a visa. So I canceled the flight. Fortunately, I got refunded my money, and I thought, what should I do with this money? And I had heard about computers, and that's all I knew about computers. And I said, you know what, I'm going to buy a computer. I could barely afford to buy one. And that summer, I did not leave my room because I got so interested in coding computers and so on, and that completely changed the trajectory of my life.
Thank you, Paolo. David, you came to AI via the games industry, and you did a PhD in reinforcement learning. What is reinforcement learning, and how did you use it in those early days?
Yeah, so I started out in the games industry before I went back to academia, and I was working on building computer games, and as a big part of building computer games is building the AI for those games that kind of makes all of the characters move around. And I found myself being fundamentally disappointed by the methods that were being used in those games. And it felt like what I really wanted to do was build something that had real AI in it. And when I started looking around at what it would mean to have something which really profoundly felt like the real thing, you know, something which was really able to learn for itself, to understand things for itself, I discovered this idea of reinforcement learning, which is basically a method very much like those that animals and humans use, where the system is able to learn for itself from experience, from trying things out and seeing what works and what doesn't. And so that's what reinforcement learning is. And so I went to study that with the father of reinforcement learning, a guy called Rich Sutton, and I traveled out to the far-flung reaches of Alberta in Canada to study my PhD in reinforcement learning.
So is it sort of like when we learn to not touch fire because at some point we try it and it really hurts and we learn don't do that in the future because the consequences aren't appealing?
Yes, it's a lot like that. In fact, humans are believed to have a major part of the brain which is devoted to providing a signal, giving feedback that makes the brain actually learn to do more of the good things and less of the bad things.
But a machine doesn't feel heat or isn't rewarded by a cookie. How can you reward a machine?
Yeah, so for a machine, it's just a number.
What?
So you give it a positive number if it's done something good and a negative number if it's done something bad. And at the end of the day, everything stems from that one single number. So this one single number, which we call the reward, contains enormous power because it's the signal that drives everything.
Wow. Paolo, you said your experiences of feeling alienated in foreign countries made you want to create an imaginary friend. And I'm sure much of our audience can relate to having an imaginary friend. But for most of us, they stay imaginary. How did you go about making a real one?
So unfortunately, there is a lot of people in need of companionship or therapy. And there is a massive gap of labor force that can provide this. As an example, to use numbers from the US, we know the prevalence of things such as autism is growing rapidly. 10 years ago, it was one out of about 200 kids. Today, it's one out of about 30 kids. So the experiences I had, which was leaving my family at a very young age, living abroad in a society that's amazing. I mean, Danes are amazing people, but yet you're different, so you're not going to be embraced. This is not too dissimilar from a child on the autism spectrum that has a hard time expressing themselves or reading emotions from other people. So they are not in tune and require therapy. So in US, as an example, for every child therapist, there's 350 children that require therapy. So there is a big labor gap here. And the question is, how do you close this gap? So we start by asking the question of what if AI not only could understand you, but actually care for you? And that was the genesis of creating a robot companion that understands human emotions, can create a deep relationship with a child, and then help them exercise and practice these social skills such as eye contact, turn-taking, joint attention, and so on, so that the child has a chance of being successful in their society.
Thank you. Regina, what can AI do when it comes to understanding cancer that humans can't?
If you are an engineer and you are a patient, it's actually a very troublesome experience because, you know, we are thinking about numbers and the probabilities, and whenever you start talking about diagnosis and what is the likelihood if I take treatment A and treatment B, you very soon realize that estimates that are given actually always are very weak estimates. So I think that in cancer and in many other diseases, the big question is always how do you deal with uncertainty? Which treatment is going to be most effective? It's again another prediction task. So pretty much if you divide every stage, it's all the matter of predictions. And unfortunately, today we rely on humans who don't have this capacity to make predictions. And as a result, many times people get wrong treatments or they are diagnosed much later. And one question that really troubled me is, you know, how late I was diagnosed. And when we already developed a model, I came back to my own mammograms and we discovered that the mammograms 2 years earlier already had on it a tiny small cancer. Now, for human eye, for radiologists, it's impossible to diagnose it because it's so, so confusing. There's so many other spots on your tissue. So what AI can do, it can do a lot of tasks which humans cannot do, take all the data that we have and remove the guessing out of diagnosis and treatment.
Thank you. David, AI had already defeated the reigning grandmaster Garry Kasparov at chess well before you started your project AlphaGo. And the rules of Go sound quite simple. Basically, on each turn, a player puts down a counter on the board and you gain territory by connecting your counters and the player with the most territory at the end of the game wins. So why is it harder for a computer to beat a human at Go than at chess, which sounds more complicated?
So the game of Go is this very beautiful and elegant game where it seems at first glance like the rules are very simple, but once you start to understand it, a bit like unpeeling an onion, you discover more and more layers of complexity. And what's amazing is that when humans play this game and you ask them to describe how they did something, they really don't know. They've used incredible intuition. And intuition and creativity are two traits which were previously considered to be very human and very hard to build into machines. So while chess, it was possible to succeed just with tactical look ahead, in the game of Go, that wasn't enough. Because, you know, early on in the game, you just have this handful of stones on the board, and you really just have to imagine what the game will pan out like, you know, 300 moves later, with this sort of intuitive sense of where it will go.
Paolo, debatably even more complex than Go is human children. Your human-centered robot forms an emotional bond with children. How can a robot do that?
Well, first of all, the robot is not meant to replace the need for human contact. It's really almost like training wheels to teach children the social skills and then be able to practice those in real life. The way the robot forms bond is that humans are wired to bonding. We create connections with inanimate objects all the time. I mean, I was also the CTO of iRobot, which does the robotic vacuum cleaners, the round ones, Roombas. People would bond with these things to the point where they will name them as they would pets. Now, with a robot that has eyes, can make eye contact, can smile back at you, and can speak to you and express emotion and empathy, it's actually not that hard to create a bond there. And children open up to these robots very quickly in ways that they may not even open up to their therapists or parents.
But you could argue that children should be focusing their time and energy on human relationships.
That is absolutely true. We would like to see that, but we unfortunately see children spending a lot of time with this device, which has been optimized to convert pixel scrolling with dopamine releases. And so, dopamine feels good, right?
So you were just holding up a phone there.
We'd rather have them spend time doing real-world activities with other people, but when you do not have a choice, if you have no friends, because you are different, and a robot is really supplement to therapy.
Thank you, Paolo. Regina, you not only made an impact on oncology, your team at MIT used AI to discover what could be our first new antibiotic in 3 decades. It seems it can be E. coli, MRSA, and strains of bacteria which are currently resistant to all other antibiotics. So I think we all wish it success. How did you do that?
So I should say that, you know, developing antibiotics is not an area with an immense competition, even though the resistance to antibiotics that we have continues to grow. This happened to be an area where pharmaceutical companies are not very active because economically it doesn't work for them. And we do need to have alternative approaches. I met a colleague and he was from biological engineering. He was working on antibiotics and he was describing the big problem of finding new molecules which are effective against resistant bacteria, but at the same time are not toxic to humans. They had some molecules screened against, I think, E. coli. We started with that and then we just gave to the machine thousands of molecules and for each molecule you knew whether it kills the bacteria or not. And it was kind of the first attempt to learn automatically how do you look at the structure of the molecule and predict whether it would have a desired effect. And another advantage of AI is that you don't bring your own biases because existing antibiotics are developed by people who kind of say, oh, if there is, this is the mechanism how it should work, let me find another molecule. And as a result, these antibiotics are really bound to fail. So you remove all the predictions that look like conventional antibiotics and we found molecules that didn't look like something human created. And it turns out in the lab that it was able to kill using a different way, and that's what made it so effective against so many different species.
So you were able to look at all these different molecules that exist and we have records of. It might be that they were tried for something else and it didn't quite work out, and then make predictions based on what you know they can do, if whether or not they might be antibiotics.
So it was actually much easier. So there are libraries of molecules that, I don't know, it can be honey molecule, it can be many other molecules. Some of these molecules were used as cancer drug and fail. Others were used for diabetes, so the whole bunch of them. And then what you do, you take, go to the lab. I didn't do that part. Obviously, my collaborators did that part. And they took cells infected with this bacteria, in this case E. coli, and they can see whether the particular existing known molecule kills it or not. Now you translated it to a standard kind of AI setting where you have training data, and once you trained it, you actually now can go to billions of molecules, and not in the lab, in silico, by the machine, and the machine can go through them and identify a subset that are likely to have the right antibacterial properties.
And Regina, your work seems to tie in with some work David is doing on protein folding. So proteins are the building blocks of life. They're made up of strings of amino acids which fold themselves into shapes. But it's famously complicated because each protein has an unimaginable number of different ways it could fold. And David, you've worked on AlphaFold, another project at Google. How is AI helping us understand this process that's so fundamental to all life?
If you think about biology and the systems that happen within the human body, they're really all governed by these amazing machines, which are the proteins in our body. And each one of them is like this tiny little machine that has some particular shape and moves around in the body to actually do things. And so to understand what a protein does, you really need to know what shape it is.
Why can't you look down a microscope or something like that without unraveling it to see what its shape is?
Well, there are much cleverer versions of that. You can do things like X-ray crystallography, but it's very hard work because these things are embedded, you know, inside the body, inside other systems. They have to be isolated. You need to, they're absolutely minuscule, so you need special methods to unlock the shape. But the difficulty is that previously, this was a process that took perhaps the length of PhD to really just figure out one single protein. It was a very expensive process. But what we were able to do was build a machine learning system, a little bit like the one Regina was describing, which is able to actually understand how sequences map into structures. And once we understood that, we were able to predict the shape of any protein with, you know, really, really high accuracy. And what that means is now there's just this freely available database that any biologist in the world, instead of having to go and spend 3 years trying to figure out what this one protein will actually look like, they can just look it up in this library and it will show them immediately this kind of amazing 3D structure. And that enables biologists to then search for new drugs, you know, new medicines. And it's opened a lot of doors in biology.
It's incredibly impressive. This is the Engineers Intelligent Machines from the BBC World Service. We'll be talking about the future of AI and its impact on society later. But first, audience, it's your turn. Does anyone have a question about something that we've discussed so far? So do just put your hand up.
Hello, panel. My name's Rob, and I'm a business and sports coach. And I'm wondering whether what you've been talking about is possible for helping humans to improve their performance at a sport?
Good question. Who's our greatest sports enthusiast? Perhaps this one is for you, David. Can we be using AI to improve sports performance?
It's a great question. There's a lot of really amazing research that's happening to try and do just that. You know, one thing which we've been doing at Google DeepMind is actually a collaboration with Liverpool Football Club to try and help them improve their tactics. So I think, you know, the amazing thing about sports is it's become, over time, so refined in terms of the particular approaches that people take that they're very open to new discoveries and new ways to do things. And so it's been really fun, actually, just watching that kind of thing unfold.
And do you think you've managed to improve Liverpool's performance?
I think you should probably ask Jurgen Klopp or someone that question. But I think the evidence is yes in certain cases.
Very cool. Thank you, David.
Hi. My question was to you, Paolo. I know you mentioned that the robots that you make are sort of like training wheels for children who may struggle with something like things like autism. What sort of measures do the robots have in place to sort of wean the children off?
So question for you there, Paolo.
That's a great question. Something we have has been top of our mind from the beginning when we designed the robot. Moxie will interact with children, understand how things are going, and then teach them certain strategies for how to deal with different certain things, where we use basic techniques from therapy, but then it will give the child a challenge every day, which is called the daily mission. Children love that, and they accept the mission, and the mission is to encourage the child to take these strategies and exercise them in the real world. For instance, building friendships is something that's hard for some of the children. Moxie will teach them techniques about how to start a conversation, talk about your favorite movie, ask them about their favorite movie, and so on. And then we'll encourage the child to say, next time you go to school, talk to your favorite person and apply this. And then tomorrow when you come back, talk to me, explain to me what you learned.
Thank you, Paolo. So if we could, yes.
Hello, my name's Pearl. I work in drug discovery. We work with quite a few AI-driven projects, but quite often we find that they produce compounds that are completely impossible to make. How do you factor that into your AI learning or making of compounds?
Regina, that one sounds perfect for you.
I remember that the first time when we produced generative models, meaning that you are you're not searching. You can say, I want these properties, and I'm going to generate from scratch molecules which have the desired profile. I remember when the first time we kind of tried this tool and they brought it to chemists from Janssen, they told me they look like beehives. They don't look like normal molecules. And since then, you know, we and many others learned our lesson. And within the last year, there was so much progress. Like if we're talking about generation of protein, and there were very significant testing that demonstrate that the model can generate. So I don't know what you guys are using, but the generative model in the last few years became much stronger, and we see, you know, much better compounds.
Thank you so much for your questions, audience. Now we must take a short pause. We'll be back in just a minute to find out more about AI and intelligent machines.
Did you know that it's 50 years this week since Richard Nixon became the first US president in history to resign from office? To mark this monumental moment, Witness History brings you 5 programs about influential events in US presidential history. And with all the amazing twists and turns in the current race for the White House, what a time to bring you them. You'll hear about the closest US election in history and from the man who was in the Situation Room during the raid on Osama bin Laden. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.
You're listening to the BBC World Service. I'm Caroline Steele, and this is The Engineers, Intelligent Machines. We've been discussing AI beating the world's greatest player of Go, predicting cancer, discovering new antibiotics, and helping with child development. I'm with three of the world's leading engineers in the field of artificial intelligence. Regina Barzilai is Distinguished Professor for AI and Health at MIT in the United States. David Silver is Principal Scientist at Google DeepMind here in the UK. And Paolo Pirjonian is the founder and CEO of Embodied, a company which builds emotionally intelligent robots. Please join me in welcoming them back. Thank you. David, let's go back to you. So far, we've been talking about systems designed to perform one task, so playing Go or understanding protein structure. That's known as narrow AI. But you're working towards artificial general intelligence. Could you explain what artificial general intelligence is?
So if you think about humans and human intelligence, it's this wonderful and beautiful thing where, you know, we're able to learn skills which are incredibly diverse, where, you know, one person might choose to specialize in learning how to play tennis, and another person might specialize in becoming an amazing chef, and another person a scientist. These brains of ours are incredibly adaptable and general in what they can do. And so when we want to build artificial intelligence, we want systems which not only solve a single problem, but in a similar manner to humans, are able to approach any number of problems with intelligence that's capable of doing amazing things in each of those different areas. And that's what we refer to as artificial general intelligence, or AGI for short.
And how far off do you think we are from that being a reality?
AGI is something which I like to think of more as a spectrum than a single moment where it's achieved, where you can think of it maybe like a landscape with all these different kind of parts of the landscape representing the different areas of human intelligence. Like maybe there's a part of the landscape that's about making movies, and another part of the landscape is about being able to play sports, and another part of the landscape about general knowledge. And we can think of this kind of ocean, which is the level of AI, and it's rising. The tide of AI is rising, and some of the islands have been kind of covered up by the water, which means that AI has now equaled or exceeded the capabilities of humans. So, you know, the game of Go, which I worked on, is one such example. But there are many, many other parts of the landscape where machines are still far off what humans can do. And so it's really a spectrum, I think, where what we'll see over time is this kind of tide, you know, rise up in different ways. And I think sometimes we're surprised by how difficult it is for AI to really achieve this one goal. So I think it's going to be a spectrum over many years. And I also think it's likely, or at least plausible, that there are many breakthroughs that are still required before we can really crack, you know, the same kind of level of intelligence that humans have.
Thank you. Regina, you've developed AI to better predict cancer, but it's only employed in a tiny number of cases. Why is AI not used more widely in medicine?
The problem is that we're creating a lot of great technology, but this technology is not really translated into patient care. And if I would ask the audience, you know, how many of you, when you last time see your physician, you actually have seen any AI? And I'm sure not many can really attest to it. So I think the technology for many of the tasks is really mature, but there are many other questions which have nothing to do with AI per se. One is a regulation. Regulations both in Europe, UK, US continue to change. Another big problem is people don't really know how to bill for AI. And today, the American doctor who uses AI loses money when they see the patient, so it's not much of the motivation. The third point is that if you look at another big innovation that happened in the last decades in medicine, for instance, genomics, there was a lot of thought placed in the medical system. How do you safely incorporate it? How do you create a clinical pipeline? But the majority of the doctors did study, you know, genomics in their medical school, but they didn't really study AI in medical school. So there is very little effort on thinking how you can safely bring these tools, which are not perfect, but still doing a lot of great things.
So just to clarify there, did you say that using AI for doctors in the US can actually make them lose money because it makes treatment more effective and therefore they're charging
The way the billing is done, it somehow relates to the time the doctor spends with the patient. So if you have something that makes it faster, you're actually losing money.
Very depressing. And Paolo, what about your challenges? The robot you've developed mimics human behavior. What's next?
Well, one thing to keep in mind is that the AI is advancing really fast right now. So one predictor or estimate is that it's about 10 times better every 6 months. But there's a compounding effect here. So if it's 10 times every 6 months, it's 100 times a year. Over 3 years, it's a million times better than where we are today. And I think what we are seeing today is just very beginning of what is happening, because the most recent breakthrough in AI that has enabled us to be where we are today is a paper released by Google in 2017. I'm very hopeful with what we are doing in terms of creating social, emotional AI systems that can help humanity become its best. If we can intervene early with children, for instance, on the autism spectrum, they have a chance of really integrating well with the society and do really well. When we think about other vulnerable areas of our life is when we age. Social isolation, being lonely, and that leads to mental health issues, that leads to physical health issues, and so on. We can have the same systems become a companion that help you there. Once we figure out the physical task, you can also imagine that they can give you assistive care, meaning that they can be not only be a social-emotional companion for you, but they can also be a companion saying, let's cook some food together, let's go for a walk together, and so on, which is going to help a lot with independent living with dignity when we are at that age.
Do you think we'll see robots helping with assistive care anytime soon, or is this way off in the distance?
I think it is within the next decade.
Oh, wow. David, you're working on Gemini, which is Google's answer to ChatGPT, and you aim for it to be able to do both tax returns and write a novel. People would probably be very happy to have their tax returns done, or I would definitely would be. But novels, should we really be letting AI sort of take over human culture?
So it's a great question. I think I wouldn't see it as taking over human culture. I think what will happen, or the most likely outcome, is that we'll be providing an incredibly powerful tool to human authors. So we've already seen this in a number of areas where we've developed technologies that enable authors of different kinds of media to basically create things much more powerfully using tools. So, for example, there's a music authoring system called Lyria that was released recently. And there's this wonderful footage of, you know, Will.i.am when he's playing with it for the first time. And he's just so excited because he says it can kind of speed up his songwriting process by, you know, 10 or 100 times, because he just gets to try out so many more ideas that are in his head. And then the system just kind of fills in the rest. So I think, you know, what I really hope we get to is a world in which the AI and the humans kind of work together to just make everything better. So, you know, I'm excited to be in a world where we have much more, the most amazing novels that we can imagine, which go far beyond the ones we have today.
And Regina, when we have humans and AI working so closely together, is there a danger that human biases are programmed into AI systems? So could there be a future where certain humans are better served by AI medicine than others?
I think it's a question that concerns many, but if you're looking at medical system that currently serves you, we do know that we are biased. There are certain populations that are really underserved because the models were created 10 years ago for the general population and you happen to have something different about yourself. And there are lots and lots of history in medicine using models which are, you know, age biased, racially biased, and so on, gender biased. So the question is, can you actually get rid of these biases when you are bringing AI? I hope. At the same time, it's really important to ensure that, first of all, we are testing the tools on very broad population. I just wanted to say about our breast tool, which is right now run on 1.4 million patients, was from many different countries with very different geographics and healthcare systems. So in order to ensure that your tools are not...
Sorry, Regina, just 1 second. Your breast tool is called Mirai.
It's called Mirai. It means future in Japanese. We actually very extensively tested it. And this brings us the question, how can you ensure that the tool that does more than the human can do, because no human can look at the image, your image, be your lung or prostate or breast, and say how likely that you're going to get cancer in 5 years. So let's say the model makes prediction, but human cannot validate it. So you need to trust the machine. So then it gives us even more concern to ensure that these tools are not biased.
Thank you. Paolo, there must be ethical concerns when it comes to robots too. What happens if, say, a robot establishes trust with a child and then the child shares thoughts of harming themselves or others? What should a robot do in that situation?
At this stage of AI, in my opinion, where we are is there's still significant limitations with AI systems. I think it would be unethical of us to allow AI deal with this type of very sensitive situations, such as self-harm and suicide. As an example, in the systems that we build, what we do is we have the full ability understanding what's going on. That's the situation. And what we do is we get the child to go talk to their parents or a trusted adult.
But how do you get a child to do that? Because they might just not do it.
They might as well not do it. We still rely on the parents to be parents, so the parents should be aware of what's going on. So we'll just hint to them that you may need to spend more time with your child. Because this is a fine balance, the child is trusting the robot, and we do not want to violate that trust. Mm. We feel it's the right line, but the line may move in the future.
Thank you, Paolo. David, I'm interested in what you call delusions, where AI behaves in an unexpected way. So in your AlphaGo project, delusions were often mistakes, but occasionally it turned out the AI was making the right decision. It just wasn't easy for humans to understand. So it's clear that we don't always understand AI's logic. So is it feasible that an AI could slip out of human's control if we can't always understand it?
So let's take the two parts of that question separately. So delusions are really interesting and challenging in the development of AI. So in AlphaGo, we saw that the system, in many cases, would play absolutely amazing Go, but then in certain situations, it would systematically get very confused and behave very oddly in the eyes of humans. And we see that kind of behavior again today with large language models, where most of the time they output, you know, really reliable information, but, you know, quite often they end up just making stuff up and producing data that just is, you know, factually incorrect.
And is that because of mistakes in the code, or is that sort of something inherent to AI that we will always see?
It's inherent to the way that these models were created so far. I don't think it's inherent to the future of AI. So I think the way that models have been trained so far, you know, really is about training on the data that's available. And you train these systems for, you know, using a lot of compute. And at the end, it has this very complicated neural network, a bit like a human brain in a way, that understands how to produce language, or in our case, the game of Go. But at the end of training, if you just stop training there, then there will always be holes that it just hasn't been trained to deal with. And I think the solution, you know, is maybe twofold. You know, what we saw in AlphaGo actually was we carried on with this project for a few years after the AlphaGo movie and the result with Lee Sedol, where we beat the world champion. And we found that we were completely able to remove delusions by really just continuing to allow the system to learn for itself and get better and better and better. And I think the difficulty with these large language models we have today is that they don't currently have that mechanism in place.
But if a system has a delusion, and I guess we're not going to know if it has a delusion until you run it, isn't it feasible that it could slip out of our control if we can't completely understand what's going on?
We definitely shouldn't put models which are capable of delusions in charge of safety critical parts of the world. You know,
sounds good.
Yeah.
Stick to playing Go or chess.
We shouldn't have, you know, today's large language models, looking after nuclear reactors. I think it's. We should understand their limitations and be very careful and cognizant of those limitations. And I think, you know, that's about managing the systems we have today. And then a big part of this is research going forward to make sure that we have systems which don't make those mistakes in the future. And I think there's a very exciting future where, just like in AlphaGo, we're able to correct all of these delusions and have, you know, models that understand how the world actually works, don't hallucinate anymore.
Thank you, David. This is the Engineers Intelligent Machines from the BBC World Service. We've discussed medical AI, emotionally intelligent robots, the goal of artificial general intelligence and the threats AI might pose. Audience, it's your turn again. Has anyone got a question on anything we've discussed so far? Wow. Okay, pretty much everyone has a hand up, so this is going to be tricky. Could we start with... Yes.
Hi, my name's Sally. Question for Paolo. I was just wondering about the friendly robot used for children with emotional and social intelligence. I was wondering if you could use it as like a mediator for conflict resolution to help children with that kind of thing.
Yes, we are actually working on something like that because conflict resolution is also part of emotional intelligence that we want children to learn. The sooner we learn it in our life, the better we are off for the rest of our life. So absolutely. We work with experts in different fields of child development to add content modules that are going to basically develop different skills for social emotional development.
I can imagine that would be useful in lots of situations, marriages, workplaces. And who are we going to next? Yes, up there. Perfect.
Hello, my name's Brian. I'm interested in the sustainability of AI, where there's lots of great use cases here, but training a large language model uses gigawatts of energy and lots of critical raw materials for the processes themselves. Do you see a way that AI will solve our energy crisis when considering the climate change that's happening?
Thank you. Regina, a small one for you there. Can AI solve climate change?
So I think there are lots of people who are trying to solve aspects of it, starting with the design of materials and other things. But I just want to kind of go back to your question about, you know, the fact that our deep learning system actually are pretty, you know, heavy energetically. There is now a part within the machine learning community. It's really looking how you can create this model smaller, how to make it more computationally efficient. For instance, we created MiniFold, which is a version of the AlphaFold, which is much smaller. You can run it. It's not so, you know, energetically heavy. But I think this whole consideration of how to ensure that we are not adding by building this model is something that community is really aware. And I personally don't work in climate change, but there are lots of exciting projects that's going on, you know, in the community trying to solve specific aspects, and I think AI would definitely play a role here.
Could we go to, right next to you, Liz, the gentleman in the pink top.
Hello, my name's Simon, and this goes to David's point earlier about AI running out of control. The British government wants to make Britain a leader in AI and sees the way to do this by making it a safe space. They're looking at doing that by making sure you can't develop AI where you don't understand the consequences before you develop it. Does the panel think that's the right approach?
So, yes. David, what do you think about legislation around AI?
I think we need some kind of regulation. I think it's an area which clearly is going to have more and more consequence and impact on society. I think some of the areas which have been agreed in various summits over the last year are, you know, a fantastic start. One thing I would say is I think it's hard sometimes to come up with like a one-size-fits-all recipe for AI because it's so different in different areas. So, you know, the regulation that you might need in medicine might look quite different to the kind of regulation you might need for, say, a chatbot. You know, we have to look at each area separately and make sure that whatever we do, you know, we really fully understand the consequences of what the impact of AI will be in that area. And I think it's something where we just, you know, need to proceed with, just careful risk assessment and making sure everyone's coming together so that all of the large companies, the universities, the people who understand the risks are all making the best possible effort to ensure that we're doing this in a way that has the best impact on society.
There's a lot of anxiety about the pace AI is moving, right? We have people resigning, leaders in the field, to campaign for more safeguarding against the threat of misinformation, the threat to jobs, and even an existential risk to humanity. What do you think of those concerns? If we start with you, Regina.
I actually feel quite opposite. I feel after years of frustration I hear from my colleagues, there is so much great things are happening. People are really suffering. There are lots of incurable diseases. It's hard for patients. It's hard for their families. There is a lot of technologies that is out there. And because we cannot get together, put the regulation in place, make the payers take part of it and find a way to bring it, I think we are really making
many, many people suffer. Comparison shouldn't be whether it is ideal, because it will never be ideal. But the question is it better than what we have now? And across many areas of drug discovery and medicine, yeah, that AI system are doing better. They're more robust. They have less biases. I think there are lots of people who are concerned. But again, if we look at the number of medical errors, of how many lives are lost, AI is definitely a great alternative to try. So no, about at least in the medicine, I don't have concerns.
Thank you. Paolo, what about robots? Are they going to take all our jobs?
Yes.
Yes. Okay, great. We've got it. We finally have an answer. Thank you, Paolo.
Well, on a serious note, I feel it's a bit of a conundrum to think about legislation, because on one hand, yes, there are definitely risks and you would like to regulate it so no one with bad intentions goes wild. On the other hand, if you think about it, it's an extremely potent technology, could change everything in our lives, including being strategically important technology to master from a national perspective. And from that perspective, if you regulate it, let's say part of the regulation is slow it down, what are our adversaries going to do? Are they going to then have an advantage over us? So it's a bit of an arms race, and I think for that reason, practically speaking, I think it's going to be very hard to regulate it to that level unless you can have international regulation and agreement across all the powerful nations to say this is how we're going to handle it. And I haven't seen that work out very well in the history of time.
I can see we've got lots of young people in the audience, some teenagers even. Does any of our younger audience have a question?
I was just wondering how you make the chips and how you code them and how it works for the AI.
Big question. Paolo, do you want to explain how you make the chips, code them, how it all works? Do you think you can do it in 30 seconds?
Probably not. You know, processors basically follow instructions, and the GPUs are graphic processing units, which were usually used for video gaming. They turn out to be super powerful in doing the type of computation required for AI algorithms like ChatGPT. How you program these things is really mostly about training. Now, there's a lot of libraries out there that are public libraries you can use to build up models. You feed it a bunch of data, which are training examples. In terms of ChatGPT, a lot of text, anything you can harvest from the web, from books and all these things. And you train it, and basically what it's learning, a system like a large language model, is what it's learning is, given this sequence of words I have seen, what is the most likely next word that should come? And if you have looked at billions and billions and billions of books, let's say, and text, you start learning the probabilities of what would be the best next word that comes after this. For instance, if I say, hello, how are you, would be the very likely next words. And this is what basically these large language models learn.
Thank you. And thank you for that excellent question. There was a young lady who had a hand up here with a ponytail. Yes.
As AI develops, I reckon that humans probably depend more on AI and maybe learn less. Is there anything we could do to maybe make sure that as AI develops, humans still develop and learn?
Ooh, good question. So will we stop learning as AI does the learning instead for us? I'm going to put that to all of you, if that's all right. Quick answer from each. What do you think, David?
I'd like to imagine a world where we have an AGI, which is like our personal friend, assistant, teacher, and everything we do, it understands what we want to learn and it knows just how to teach us and help us to learn more and more and more and more. And I think that is within the capabilities of AI to create in the future. And I'm really looking forward to learning from one of those and being able to continue learning forever.
Oh, but that really depends on the person, doesn't it? How you're going to use your AGI. Are you going to use it to learn more or do less? Regina, what do you think? Do you think we're just going to end up relying on AI for everything?
As a non-native speaker of English, I remember as a young professor, I spent a humongous amount of time like reading my papers and making sure, you know, because in my native language, We don't have an there, so I make a lot of mistakes when I write. And the rules that you have, they're actually not very clear for somebody who doesn't born with utilizing an there. I see now how I write papers. Actually, it removes a lot of my pressure in writing, and I can really focus on ideas rather than doing the small things. So I hope that we will find a symbiosis. We don't really remove our basic skills, but we can just do more and focus on the things that we can do better.
Paolo.
I would like to imagine if Isaac Newton or Albert Einstein had access to these tools today. I mean, as prolific as they were at a time where we didn't even have our calculators, imagine what they would have done and the impact it would have had on the world if they had access to these tools. So I think it allows us to evolve and elevate, and we will learn more, and we'll go to more abstract things, even things such as coding. In the next 5 years, potentially, you don't need to code. You will just tell your AI, favorite AI system, and say, I want a code that does X, Y, Z, and you can accomplish what would take years of many people in hours today. So it will make you more prolific.
Thank you. I think it's fair to say all three of you have given us hope for the future. Audience, thank you so much for your questions. I wish we could take more, but I'm afraid we're out of time. That's it for the Engineers Intelligent Machines at Imperial College London. I'm Caroline Steele. On behalf of the BBC World Service, our partners, the Royal Commission for the Exhibition of 1851, and my producer, Charlie Taylor, please join me in giving a warm round of applause for our brilliant, pioneering AI engineers, Regina Barzilai, Paolo Pigeonian, and David Silver.
Did you know that it's 50 years this week since Richard Nixon became the first US president in history to resign from office? To mark this monumental moment, Witness History brings you 5 programs about influential events in US presidential history. And with all the amazing twists and turns in the current race for the White House, what a time to bring you them. You'll hear about the closest US election in history and from the man who was in the Situation Room during the raid on Osama bin Laden. That's Witness History from the BBC World Service. Listen and subscribe wherever you get your BBC podcasts.